Looks like we don't have a quorum yet, but I think we'll get started. We've got an aggressive agenda today. Representative Simon is here to present House File 786. Greg Davids is the author, couldn't be here, and Representative Simon is a co-author who's going to present. So I think we'll start presenting, and then once we get a quorum, I'll interrupt and call the meeting officially to order and move your bill. That'd be okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a technical matter, I move that House File 786 be recommended to pass and re-refer to, I believe, the General Register.
Yes.
That's the proper motion. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I was just called into service about 10 minutes ago because Representative Davids is presiding over his own committee, I think, right now, and asked if I could fill in. This is essentially a technical bill, but one that I think will help a lot of our charities in the state, our nonprofits. As you may know, they have to register right now with the Attorney General's office every year, and among the items in registration that they have to provide is the compensation and benefits of certain officers or employees of those nonprofits. We don't change that at all, nor would we ever want to. This just simplifies it to make sure that we're in harmony with a federal change already so that the act of reporting will be simpler. So this isn't hedging or getting around any reporting. It's making it simpler for the charities, same information. And to explain why that's true, I'll turn it over to someone from the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits to explain. Thanks.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just please state your name and who you're with for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Jeannie Fox. I'm the Deputy Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. And I thank Representative Davids and our other authors here looking at this very small but we think important bill. The only thing I would add in addition to what Representative Simon has described is that I think it actually enhances accountability and transparency in that right now the Attorney General's report lumps salary and benefits together. The IRS way takes salaries right off the W-2. Benefits are included on a separate line, and this would be the same way. So it's still reporting the same information, but it's making it more clear. And when the page has a minute, I also have a letter from the Charities Review Council, and Gino from the CPA Society is here. Council on Foundations supports this bill as well. So we've got the charities, the accountants, the watchdog groups all believe this actually increases and enhances transparency. So I think it accomplishes three things: donor protection, clarity, and ease, and I would appreciate your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, meeting will officially come to order. We do have a quorum. We do not have the minutes prepared yet, so we will move on, and Representative Simon moves House File 786 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. And there is an amendment. And did you want to move your amendment, Representative Simon?
Yes, please, Madam Chair. And I don't have it in front of me. What is the number?
A1.
A1, okay. Madam Chair, I move the A1 amendment. Okay,
Representative Simon moves the A1 amendment.
And just to explain, I can claim no credit for this. All credit is due to Mr. Shepard, who, as usual, notices things that we don't, and he noticed just a technical glitch that needs to be fixed in order to effectuate the intent here, which is to report everything, but just change the way that it's reported to comport with federal law. Mr. Shepard, can you just describe for the committee why we need this technical fix?
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon and members, this amendment is just intended to ensure that the compensation will continue to be reported. As drafted, the bill created the implication that if you see on lines 2 and 3, it struck the requirement to report total compensation, and this reinstates words so that compensation will be reported and in the manner that Ms. Fox and Representative Simon described.
Representative Simon?
Urge a yes vote.
Okay. Any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment does prevail. Back to the bill. Does anyone have a question, or does anyone else need to testify on the bill? Is there Gino Fragnito? Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gino Fragnito, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota CPA Society. And we support this bill and look at it as another step in conformity and moving towards providing those that are filing these types of documents with the state and with the federal government some consistency in their filing, and so that they're not having to keep two different sets of records and file two different reports. It also, I think, in the long term, will make the reporting consistent, so that the public data is out there in one format and people are more easily able to find it.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Any other questions for the author, the co-author? Seeing no further questions, Representative Simon renews his motion that House File 786 be recommended to pass and be placed in the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. Now, thank you very much, Representative Simon, for taking on that task. Next, we'll move to House File 864, which is my bill, and I will ask Representative Murray to chair while I'm at the table.
Okay, Representative Pepin, would you like to move your bill?
I will, Mr. Chair. I will move that House File 864 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to State Government Finance.
Okay. Go ahead and explain your bill then.
House File 864, just a fairly simple bill. It authorizes the Commissioner of Revenue to enter into a reciprocal agreement with the federal government for collection of unpaid debts through the Federal State Administrative Offset Program. And in order to do that, we have to do a couple of things, which we will talk about in a minute. And we believe that the state will have the ability to offset their debts against hundreds of thousands of federal non-tax benefit payments every week, which could result in several million that we can add to our bottom line, perhaps $20 million in the first year, $21 million in the first year, something like that, and then $15 million per year after that. And I have with me Jim Girard, who is going to kind of walk us through how this works in detail.
Okay, Mr. Girard, would you like to state your name for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Girard. I'm with Cook Girard Associates, and I'm here today representing Deloitte Consulting. This bill is fairly simple. What it does is, as Representative Pepin said, it allows the state to enter into agreement with the federal government under their Treasury Offset Program. And currently the state of Minnesota does a good job of collecting debts and does offset tax debts already with the federal government. This would allow the state to expand and collect debts, or collect through payments beyond taxes. A common example would probably be contractor payments, where perhaps someone did work in the state of Minnesota, left the state of Minnesota, continues to do work perhaps for the federal government. The payments for that, payments that would go to that contractor if they left the state of Minnesota with a tax debt or with a debt, that the payment could be offset for the amount that's owed the state of Minnesota. So it would be an expansion of the current program. This was signed into law in 1996 by then President Clinton, and at that time, essentially nothing happened on this part of it, although it was allowed. And in 2005, the federal government started the process of working with states to help offset and collect more debts. In 2007, two states went up. New Jersey and Maryland were the first two states to start and work with the program. It would allow the state to collect tax liabilities from withholding sales and use tax S corporations. It would also allow state liabilities to be offset, like fines, fees. The fines could be through DNR, environmental fine, PCA fines, things like that. So it would broaden beyond just the tax-to-tax offsets that occur now. Like I said, the state of Minnesota does a good job, and the Department of Revenue already does a significant amount of collections for the state. So this would actually that would help streamline this process, because we have been very aggressive in pursuing debts due to the state of Minnesota. This would just put one more tool in the toolbox, I suppose would be a good way to put it. Before just just so that people understand, before any offset would occur, the debt would have to be 90 days old, for one thing. It would have to be an old debt, and I suspect that it would probably be significantly older than that. The debtor would get a certified letter stating that the offset was going to take place. They would then have 60 days to make good on the debt before the offset would occur, before the collection would occur. What happened in Maryland when the program started in 2007, a large number of the people that owed money to the state paid before the 60 days were up. That money never got counted as part of the offset program. But in spite of that, Maryland, which is a little smaller than Minnesota, collected $20 million through the program with the federal government in the first year. So it was a pretty substantial chunk of money that the state was able to get on the first year. Since then, and that was 2007, they've been collecting about $15 million of the program per year. So it's been successful at getting debts that I think a state would probably have a difficult time getting from debtors, in some cases simply because they weren't doing business in the state, didn't live in the state, didn't have a tax liability in the state. So it expands the ability of state government to collect debts that are owed to the state.
Okay, anybody have any questions? Representative Beard?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand that this is only for governmental debts. Private debts are not involved in this. First question I have to speeding tickets, parking tickets, things like that, are they going to start showing up? And because I know the government tracks a lot of stuff we do now, and I'm just wondering if these are going to show up on my federal tax return if it turns out I got an outstanding speeding ticket.
Mr.
I don't think I do, but just...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, I don't know. I suppose it's possible it could, but I think it's highly unlikely. I haven't gone that deep into it yet.
Yeah.
Representative Pepin?
Representative Beard, I do have a list of some examples mm-hmm. in front of me. Some examples would be tax refunds, wages, retirement, contractor payments, travel advancements, you know, other types of federal payments. I don't think that would probably fall in it, but those are the examples I was given.
Thank you. The second question is related to, and maybe if you could expand a little more on the notification process, because I'm thinking about, and every business person goes through this, at some point, Minnesota Revenue in particular, which is a little more tenacious and persnickety than the IRS, will oftentimes make some outlandish claims. For instance, I got a demand letter several years ago for like $8,900 back taxes for Minnesota Revenue. About the time we got it cleared up, it turns up I owed like $44 or something like that. But it took us more than a year of wrangling with them to help them see the light and drop the, and by the way, I never even got an I'm sorry note. It was just a demand note for $44. I remember this incident because Minnesota Revenue has a reputation for how they deal with small businesses. At what point does it go beyond the contention where you're challenging and you're trying to work it out before they pull the trigger and report it to the feds and things happen?
Mr. Jard?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, I can't answer that specifically except to say that as long as you are working and negotiating with the Department of Revenue,
it's probably
they
not
are
considered
not going
a bad
to go to this okay. extent collected.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm hopeful that reason and sanity will prevail, but I've got some experience that tells me you understand why I'd be a little suspicious, but thank you for the clarification.
Okay. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also have two questions. Would this affect anything like child support in any case?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, we have a different program in place for child support, and that is already in law and is so there. Because of that, this wouldn't be part of that.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my other question was, in the bill, it talks about a reasonable administrative fee, and I'm wondering how that would be established by rule, and then that would be charged as well to the debtor. And we have a any kind of an idea of how that would be determined?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, that would depend on how the department sets the program up. In Maryland, the fee starts out as it starts out as 12%, or then that's paid by the debtor within the collection. That's a fairly low fee for this type of collection. Other agencies that do this sort of thing, like more. In Maryland, it's a private company that does it. Deloitte handles the program in Maryland. How other states do it, I'm not sure.
Representative Nelson. Oh, excuse me, Representative Pepin.
Thank you. And Representative Scalzi, I just wanted to add to that. And it says the commissioner may. The commissioner could also do it themselves. There have been states that have done it without contracting with an outside vendor, and I think they wanted to talk about that. I think there are advantages to using an outside vendor, and I think that other states have demonstrated more of a return, but that is, you know, something that would be under negotiation, so it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to under this language. It says they may.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a few questions. One is, you said you've listed New Jersey and Maryland. Are there more states that are doing this that have these agreements? And are these just the two most recent?
Mr. Gerard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, actually those are the first two. New York is also doing it, and they haven't been doing it as long and don't have the track record. And there are other states, I believe, that are in the pipeline right now to start doing it. Kentucky, Wisconsin, and West Virginia are
Representative Nelson, a
thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question I have has to do how much. I mean, you said Maryland's collected 20 and 21, and you're expecting to do the same thing here. How much outstanding debt do we have as a state that we're looking at that this would allow us to collect? Because I guess I'm looking at Maryland being close to Washington. There's probably more contractors that cross the border and do work, federal government work there. That to me, that it looked like there might be a better chance or more opportunity for them. So how much debt do we actually have? And so that we're basing these numbers of $20 and $21 million that we will be able to collect.
Mr. Gerard?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, I'm not sure, but I'm sure the Department of Revenue probably has a better idea on that. We have a significant amount, but I don't know.
Okay. Is there somebody that could get that information to us or here that could add that?
Okay. Okay, if we could interrupt here just for a second. Representative Winkler, you have some guests here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To demonstrate the high level of civic engagement and attention to public policy, and which I think results in some excellent representation here at the Capitol, the St. Louis Park High School students are here again today, ninth graders, and please join Representative Simon and I in welcoming them.
Welcome. We're glad to have our future leaders here with us. Okay. Ms. Steinbeck, please state your name for the record and proceed.
For the record, my name is Terry Steenblock, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes for the Department of Revenue. The question was asked as far as how much accounts receivable is outstanding at this time. At this time, the delinquent accounts receivable is at approximately $400 million.
Okay, is there a follow-up, Mr. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess then the question I asked is, can we look to have the same type of payback as like Maryland does? They're saying $20, $21 million. Is that accurate numbers that you think we could, with this program, we'd be able to collect?
Ms. Steinbeck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was a little bit about what we're doing today. And first, I'd like to thank Representative Pepin for bringing the bill forward. And while the department does not have a position on it, we did want to share with you what we're currently doing and what revenue has been generated as a result of that, and then some opportunities we have going forward. And I did have a handout, I think, that may have been passed out to you. If you look at that on the current, there's a side that says current reciprocal agreement. Should I turn? Okay. Right now, as was already mentioned, The department is already participating in a few different reciprocal agreements, and there has been some revenue that's already been generated as a result of that. One of those, as you look at this list here, is the federal to state offset for tax debts. So what that means is that if somebody owes an individual income tax, the Department of Revenue already has the opportunity to send a notification to the Treasury. And at that time, the Treasury is then aware that a debt is outstanding, and if the individual has a refund coming from the IRS, that is captured, and the portion owed to the state is sent to us, and then the remainder of the refund is sent out to the individual taxpayer. That program has been in place since fiscal year 03, and the revenue that Minnesota has already generated as a result of that is $41.8 million, and that's through FY10. So we have ongoing revenue that's already generated as a result of that. One of the second programs that we have that we started in February of 2010 is state to federal offset, and what that is if somebody owes the IRS a tax debt, the IRS can submit a claim to us, and then we can offset that and send the money to the IRS, and the remainder goes towards the refund. With that, we do collect a fee. There is a statute that Minnesota Statute 270C.41 does allow us to collect a $20 fee. And so you'll notice on that chart we've collected $118,000. And again, that's a new program that we've implemented. And then third on the list, back in March of 2009, we started partnering with the state of Wisconsin to offset debts, individual tax debts for each other. That's a relatively new program. With that particular one, we have collected $157,000 and fees of $16,000. We don't see a lot of revenue generated as a result of that, but it is another tool in the compliance piece of it. If you flip it over, we talk about some optional reciprocal agreements, and this may be where Representative Pepin's bill could come into play. We have worked very hard with our new integrated system to make sure that we've positioned the new integrated system to allow us to expand reciprocal agreements if we chose to do so. So technology-wise, we're already set up to be able to do that. We wanted to wait for a couple different things to happen. So as you may or may not know, we collect debts for other state agencies. They're required by law to refer their debts to us. And that is scheduled to be the fourth rollout of our integrated system, which will be implemented in December of this year. So we wanted to wait until we had that implementation done and we're stabilized there. Also, when we're doing an offset program with the feds and we want to look at those vendors and those contractors, there's an impact to the statewide financial system. So we wanted to wait until the new SWIFT program was implemented, which I think is scheduled for July. When those two things happen, two of the programs that we would like to explore would be that non-tax debt option, which has been talked about already. So that would allow us to expand the current agreement that we already have in place with the feds to collect those non-tax debts. So for example, if the DNR referred a debt to the Department of Revenue, we would be then able to send that to the feds, and if there was a vendor or contractor payment that needed to be offset, we would have the ability to offset that and get that there. The feds do charge a fee to do that, and I believe right now the fee is $21 to offset that. The other option we would have would be to reciprocate that for the feds, where the feds would have the ability to send something to us that is non-tax debt, and we would be able to offset that. So we do currently have the authority under contract right now to be able to partner with different entities to collect debts. We would be very happy to participate in some review of the statutory language and possibly expanding that language. And an example of that would be, the language that you have in front of you is listed under 16D. 16D is the language that allows us, gives us permission to collect those other state agency debts. We would for example, want to talk about possibly adding something to the tax language as well, so we would have the authority to do it for both tax and other agency debt. So we would be happy to explore language enhancements and talk about some future possibilities there as well. So with that, I'll kind of open it up with questions, but I've shared some stats there as far as what we've collected to date.
Okay, is there any questions? Representative Nelson? Oh, okay, thank you. Anybody else? Hearing none, are there any other testifiers that would like to speak for or against this bill in the audience? Seeing none, Representative Pepin, would you like to have any other comments on your bill?
No, I think that pretty much sums it up, and I'll continue to have conversations with the department. I'm hoping that perhaps we can move up that December date, because I think I know that if we were to look at some of the private vendors, I understand that they could do it within as little as a couple of months, which would allow us to work on our budget situation here. So I will continue to have those conversations, and hopefully we can have more in state government finance.
Okay, thank you. With that, Representative Pepin renews her motion that House File 864 be recommended to pass and be referred to state government finance. Any further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you. Okay, Representative Gottwald, would you like to come up?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Gottwald.
Appreciate it. Would you like to move my bill?
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 199 be passed and move on to
Government Finance.
Government Finance Committee.
Okay, Representative Kwa moves that House File 199 be recommended to pass and be referred to State Government Finance. To your bill, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, House File 199, the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act, is Minnesota's declaration of independence from the unconstitutional provisions of the so-called Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. Our mantra throughout this session, at least in our Health and Human Services Committees, has been the critical need to protect Minnesota's lead in healthcare and healthcare reform. Our state has the lowest costs and best outcomes of almost any other state in the nation. We have among the highest percentage of our residents with access to healthcare coverage, and we have made huge strides in the areas of health technologies, data, transparency, and numerous other areas. Our friends in Washington, with whom I've met, acknowledge Minnesota stands head and shoulders above the rest of the nation in terms of health care. On behalf of all Minnesotans, we must not surrender our health care leadership. And while we know there are many areas in which we need to improve to provide greater access to higher quality and more cost-effective health care, we know Minnesota has the ability to get there without a massive federal government takeover of health care and insurrection of states and individuals' rights. The Obamacare legislation also raises serious concerns across broad fronts. The constitutionality issues are foundational to our democracy and demand the utmost deference. House File 199 declares that Obamacare's individual mandate and penalties associated with it are outside the powers given to federal government under our U.S. Constitution. The Constitution, by the way, members and Madam Chair, that each of us has sworn to uphold. When we take our oath of office, we swear to uphold the Minnesota and U.S. Constitution. So these are not minor issues, they're not trivial, they're not sideline issues. They're absolutely fundamental to what we do as state legislators. All Americans should be concerned about the appropriate role of our government in light of this imperial legislation. As a matter of state policy, this bill clearly states that those powers are ours, not the federal government's. It states that Minnesota exercises its sovereign power to declare the public policy of the state regarding the right of persons to choose the mode of securing health care services. It declares that it is the public policy of the state that every person within the state is and shall be free to choose or decline any mode of securing health care services without penalty or threat of penalty. House File 199 further prohibits state officials from enforcing such federal mandates or penalties, and it directs our Minnesota Attorney General to act on our behalf in defending our state's rights and to remove us from any unfunded mandate resulting from Obamacare. And then there are the innumerable concerns about what the Obamacare legislation will do to Minnesota's nation-leading health care system. I've provided several handouts that detail some of these concerns, ranging from unsustainable cost increases for states and overwhelming bureaucracies, elimination of choice and rationing, to destruction of the private health care coverage market in favor of an all-out federal government takeover of health care. The Congressional Budget Office has already indicated the federal legislation will add billions of federal dollars to the total cost of health care in our nation, and the Medicaid expansions alone are expected to add billions to the cost to the state of Minnesota. Many of us are convinced these estimates grossly understate the real total impacts when the entire bill comes due. Madam Chair and members, I do not offer this bill lightly. We are at a critical crossroads on the issues surrounding true health care reform and the legitimate role of government. We have an obligation to the citizens of Minnesota to protect their legitimate interests and powers under the Constitution, and particularly in the area of health care. I urge you to stand up for Minnesotans and support the Minnesota Freedom of Choice in Health Care Act. And Madam Chair, with that, I'll take questions. We also have some presenters, and I'm not sure what order you want to take things in, but I'll stand for questions.
Okay, I think we'll take a few questions first. Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, I guess a question about the purview of this committee. I assume that the issues related to health care costs, mandates for, as it relates to health care policy and finance, et cetera, are not something you wish us to discuss.
Correct. We could have Mr. Shepherd talk about the items in our purview if you'd like.
And yeah, Madam Chair, I think that'd be helpful. And I'd also, I guess my general question is, you know, we're essentially talking about an argument about the Constitution here and not much else. So is this the proper, I assume this is a good committee for that, the role of the state in its relation to the federal government?
Representative Gottwald wanted to comment first.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I think we pretty clearly stated in the presentation that we are, in fact, in this bill directing the Attorney General's Office of the State of Minnesota to take certain actions. I believe that's in the purview of this committee, if I'm not mistaken, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to comment further, Mr. Shepherd, on the purview? You know, I think okay. It's fairly straightforward.
Madam Chair, then I just have some questions about how this bill is supposed to work. I mean, we've got a lot of statement of public policy and so forth, which has dubious merit. But I would just want to understand the enforcement provision of the bill. I gather that you're specifically concerned about the individual, the mandate to purchase health care insurance. Are there other provisions of the Health Care Act that you want to include that are supposed to be included here?
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, it's actually broader than that. We're not only talking about individuals' rights, we're talking about states' rights. There is, under Obamacare, a very strong possibility that we're incurring unfunded mandates on the state of Minnesota, directions for what we do with our private insurance market, and directions of what the state of Minnesota should do on its own behalf that clearly step outside the federal government's bounds within the Constitution. And again, this bill asks that it actually directs our AG's office to defend Minnesota's rights on behalf of both individuals and states' rights.
Madam Chair, maybe I can be more specific.
Representative Winkler.
Page 2, lines 2.14 to 2.17. It's entitled Subdivision 4, Enforcement. No public official, employee, or agent of the state of Minnesota or any of its political subdivisions shall act to impose, collect, enforce, or effectuate any penalty in the state of Minnesota that violates the public policy set forth in this section. Are there other penalties contained in Obamacare that would besides the individual mandate, that would fall under that section that I just read to you?
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, I'm not aware of any other under this section. On the other hand, we are also still learning a great deal about the ACA, and one of the problems we have with it in general is that we don't have a lot of clarity yet, but that is clearly one of the things we do know for sure is there is a penalty.
Representative Winkler.
And Madam Chair, under the ACA, would our state employees, agents, or officials, including local subdivisions, are they required to impose, collect, enforce, or effectuate that penalty, or is that strictly done through the IRS or some other federal agency?
Representative Gutwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, this entire Obamacare legislation is really run by the HHS department and the federal government. Now, the imposition of this penalty is clearly described as a penalty, both in the federal legislation and elsewhere. I understand there have been arguments that because it's taxation, it's not considered a penalty, but even the Obama administration has called this a penalty. They haven't called it tax, they've called it penalty. In fact, the language was actually changed in the drafting of the bill to move away from the tax terminology towards penalty. So there's a great deal of evidence that this is not simply a taxation issue, it's a penalty. It's a penalty if you do not follow the federal government guidelines, particularly with regard to the individual mandate, but also on some employers. If they decide not to provide certain benefits, they are then penalized. So I think there's a pretty clear record that it's a penalty, not just a tax.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Gottwald, I'm really trying to understand the mechanics. Are state employees or local employees going to be involved in effectuating, collecting, or enforcing such a penalty?
Representative Gutwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, for one, we have the insurance exchange, which is clearly part of this, that does a great deal of directing. And furthermore, the part about what we're directing our AG to do, Representative Winkler, Madam Chair, is to defend Minnesotans' rights. It's not asking them to implement the penalty. It's asking them to defend our rights as citizens and as a state of Minnesota against the penalties. And I think that's a little bit different, but still very much germane to what we're dealing with here.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Gall, I'm trying to understand the specifics. I'm trying to understand whether your bill is constitutional or not, because, or if it's just completely unnecessary. Because if we're going to have local or state officials involved in helping with the enforcement of federal law, then your bill does something. It tells them not to do it. If those people wouldn't be involved anyway, then the section that I read to you would be unnecessary. So I'm trying to understand, what are the facts? Are they going to be involved in doing this or not? You know, I'm just really trying to understand.
Madam Chair, if I may, I think it might be helpful if we had our presenters finish their presentation, that perhaps Representative Winkler and the members would have more understanding of the bill on which to base their questions.
Okay, Madam Chair, then if the presenter
can
try to address the specific question on that section, that would be helpful.
Well, why don't we have, are there more than one three presenters? Maybe we'll have the presenters, then we'll open it up and you can ask whomever you'd like the questions. We'll go from there. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Pepin. My name is Dave Racer, members. I'm a resident of the east side of St. Paul. I guess I'm a member, too. I've been married for more than 43 years and have 5 children and 5 grandchildren, all of whom are citizens of Minnesota. And I come here today to speak in support of the Freedom of Choice and Health Care Act. Madam Chair, I have a copy of my statement here for you. I would like to have you get that. Also, I have a copy of a resolution that I'm going to refer to in a minute, passed by my student senate. A bit about my background. I am a past president of the Constitution Educational Foundation and the founding president of the Declaration Foundation. For the past 12 years, I've taught an American government class for homeschoolers that emphasizes a line-by-line study of the Constitution. I wrote the workbook for this course. Over the last 10 years, I've taught a course called Student Senate. This year, my Student Senate has 37 members and a bureaucracy greater than yours. But what we do is go through the process that you go through every day and study issues. I'm going to refer to that again in just a second. During the past 6 years, I've co-authored 4 books on healthcare reform, with almost 150,000 copies in print. And 2 years ago, I earned my master's degree from Oxford Graduate School with a thesis that was on comprehensive healthcare reform. My doctoral studies are going to focus on the role of faith and how it should inform the way we consume healthcare. And I think you'll understand there's a reason why I'm giving you all this. I've spoken to a variety of audiences in more than 25 states. In fact, I head to Lubbock, Texas tonight to do that. I briefed and advised members of Congress and of this body. And though I'm not a health insurance agent, I am a member of the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, where I sit on their legislative committee. And lastly, I'm on the board of the Minnesota Physicians and Patients Alliance. So I've studied and written about healthcare delivery and payment systems from a broad national and state perspective. In 2010, my student senate unanimously passed a resolution asking Attorney General Lori Swanson to challenge the federal takeover of healthcare. That's what I'm having distributed to you right now. I hope you'll take a moment and read and study what 32 student senators had to say so eloquently a year ago. I assert that if they can understand it, certainly any member of this body can understand it. And I don't say that to cast aspersions, but as we've given this testimony in other places, we've had members of the committees question why they should even be discussing constitutional issues. And I have to tell you that such an assertion in front of my students would be astonishing, that the Constitution would not be of a concern to all of you in everything that you do. The new federal law contains a few good ideas and a lot of bad ideas. In fact, the more we're finding out about it, the more we discover what a failure it is. That's for another time. But even if it all made sense, even if all its projections were right, you should still oppose it. Several weeks ago, Vermont's policyholders decided that policymakers decided to pass a single-payer healthcare system for their state. And here in Minnesota, there's been an effort to do that. A number of you, perhaps, on this committee favor that system. And frankly, I strongly oppose it. I would be here speaking against it on a number of bases. But I do defend your right to do that. The federal healthcare law would not allow you to do that based on all of its strictures. On the other side of that, pushing for a really robust, vibrant private health care system, which some of us would strongly support. We want the freedom to continue to do that in Minnesota. So you're going to hear a lot of legislation this session to strengthen market-based health insurance reforms. And I strongly support most of those. And my guess is some of you are going to oppose them. But just as strongly, you're going to support our right to bring those before your body and let them be heard. We shouldn't have to beg Washington, D.C. for permission to do what's best for Minnesota. The Affordable Care Act robs you as policymakers and us as citizens of our right to create and participate in a health care system that's uniquely Minnesotan. The Freedom of Choice and Health Care Act is a step toward setting this right. The United States Constitution is a contract between three parties. First, sovereignty is in the hands of we the people. The other two parties are the states and the federal government. This is the ultimate and most important separation of powers. To preserve this separation of powers and to protect against the continuous encroachment of the federal government on those powers, I call on you as Minnesota legislators to reassert our rights. As my students pointed out, forcing someone to purchase a product or service over which they have no control at a price they cannot negotiate for a purpose they may or may not support flies in the face of liberty. The federal mandate to buy insurance is an astonishing assault on individual freedom. In 1976, Minnesota created the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association to provide guarantee issue health insurance for our residents, and it's far superior to the new federal high-risk pool model. It's a Minnesota model. Despite funding $5 billion the ACA did for their high-risk pools, 12,500 people have now enrolled, despite the fact that the lawmakers said 375,000 would have enrolled by this time. If they're that far off on those projections, my goodness, where are they going to be 10 years from now? Minnesota's consistently led or nearly led the country with the lowest uninsured rates. Our health care services, although plenty expensive, are more affordable than in many, many states and cities. Minnesota wants medical innovation. The list is long. We did this here without the overreach of the federal government. And more than 25, and yes, I think it is 28 states now, are working to pass this legislation. So the argument that Minnesota really has no standing to do this is quite specious. They get it. We get it. So please, I do urge you to support and vote for this Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act. And Madam Chair, as to the member's question about penalties and how they might be enforced, there really are a number of these. The exchange is only one example, but there are a number of other penalties and extensions of that by implications of the policymakers. We don't even know what the rules are yet. They're going to be required and imposed on insurance companies in Minnesota and the cost of those. So it is a significant potential for abuse. And lastly, the exchange itself is going to be deeply involved in the collection of data that's going to be required to enforce the collection of penalties and to prove that individuals have coverage.
Thank you, Representative Bowell.
And Madam Chair, if I might, I know Representative Winkler had asked a very specific question about a specific section, and I've had a moment to go over it a little bit more. Representative Winkler, this whole section, Subdivision 4, line 216 through 219, is meant to say specifically, I think we've talked about the exchange and state government officials' involvement in creating the exchange. And again, we are, as I mentioned earlier, hearing more and more about what might be done under an exchange, what might be required of state officials, what might constitute a penalty under exchanges, and how state officials through the exchanges are going to be asked to implement the federal policy. So in answer to your question, I think there's a lot of concern in that area, and that's the exact reason we put this section in, is to cover those sorts of potentialities, if you will. Right now, we are still hearing from the federal government about how they plan to implement this section, but it is not... it's not a stretch of the imagination by any means to think that state officials are going to be asked to enforce and, in fact, regulate a great deal of what's going on under Obamacare through the insurance exchanges.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Gottwald, I guess that at least is helpful because now you're indicating that state officials will be involved in implementing and that this section of law that or of the bill that we're talking about would involve state officials. But what if, just hypothetically speaking, the ACA is challenged to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court says it's constitutional. We have a necessary and proper clause in the Constitution. We have a commerce clause, and the 10th Amendment has never really been used in the way that this bill describes. And the Supreme Court says, enforce it. State is constitutional. Minnesota, enforce it. What happens to this language if we pass this law?
Representative Gutwald?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, my first response is we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule on this perhaps sometime late next year. And I think that's a very valid discussion for them to have. If it's ruled constitutional in whole or in part, obviously, that constitutionality supersedes this.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Gottwald. I don't think of you that way, Madam Chair. Representative Gottwald, so what you're essentially, so this bill would basically say that until a federal law has been upheld by the Supreme Court, it's Minnesota is free to disregard its enforcement.
Representative Gottwald.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, no, I would disagree with that. I think what this says is Minnesota, on behalf of its residents, its citizens, looks at the U.S. Constitution, looks at the Ninth Amendment, the Tenth Amendment, and declares its state's rights under this. Now, if the U.S. Supreme Court seeks to circumvent that, that's up to the U.S. Supreme Court. This bill says Minnesota is declaring on behalf of its residents that we do not consider the federal law as passed to be constitutional in terms of states' rights and individual rights. And we're asking the state of Minnesota to stand up for those rights right now on behalf of its residents. It, in fact, directs the AG to file a lawsuit on the state's behalf in that regard. And I think those are perfectly valid things to do right now. In fact, we ought to be doing it right now before the U.S. Supreme Court ends up hearing the case.
Madam Chair, I'm still, I just want to make sure I understand. So until the U.S. Supreme Court decides otherwise, it's, if we pass this into law, it's the policy of the state of Minnesota that the federal law is unconstitutional. So that Minnesota basically passes its judgment on the constitutionality of a validly passed act of Congress, and until it's enforced or upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, states may choose to implement or not implement, regard or disregard the federal law.
Madam Chair,
Representative Gutwell?
Representative Winkler, to a certain extent, you're right. But again, I'll put this more proactively. This bill is declaring under the U.S. Constitution, right? The U.S. Constitution is constitutional by its nature. Under the existing U.S. Constitution, there are states' rights, Ninth Amendment, Tenth Amendment. And the state has a right to invoke those constitutional rights now. I mean, and all we're asking is that we protect Minnesota's rights under the existing U.S. Constitution. We firmly believe that Obamacare is unconstitutional in these regards, and it declares that. 27, 28 other states are already doing this exact same thing. It is perfectly right for a state to declare its own rights under the U.S. Constitution and seek to defend those on behalf of its citizens.
Okay. Hold on a second. Mr. Racer, did you have a comment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, there are two states so far who have resisted implementation. We don't know that there won't be others. And yet the other states have gone ahead and done this sort of legislation as a statement from the state that they believe the act is unconstitutional. That alone will have a great bearing on the Supreme Court when it rules in 2012. So we as citizens are asking you to stand with us in an assertion of our rights as individuals and as states. One other thing I might mention, I found there's a bill in Texas right now. In Texas is quite a bit different than Minnesota. That is calling for a constitutional convention for the specific purpose of passing protection for states' rights to clarify states' rights, and there's nothing that precludes this body from joining that kind of a movement if that law is upheld or you feel that you need to make a stronger statement. Essentially, you're making a statement here.
Madam Chair, finally, like I'm getting somewhere with
sure.
this.
Representative Winkler, I do have several people on the list, and I do have a couple more people in Representative Gutwell's presentation. Do you want to maybe ask one more question and then hold on to later? Or?
Well, Madam Chair, I feel like I'm trying to get to sort of the point about whether this bill is legal or not, and it's taking some time getting there. And so, Madam Chair, Representative Gutwell, you mentioned a resolution. Type thing where you say basically we think this is unconstitutional. You've mentioned constitutional convention where the states say, hey, let's change the Constitution. And you've mentioned forcing the Attorney General, Mr. Racer did, to go to litigation, which is another way of saying, hey, this is unconstitutional. But this bill actually says that that a federal law is not enforceable in the state of Minnesota until a court says otherwise. So you're presuming that the federal law is unconstitutional. And Representative Gutwell, that issue has been decided under the U.S. Constitution for about 150 years. It was called the Civil War. And included in this bill is not, you know, something that would make Dixie the state song or replacing Abraham Lincoln's portrait with Jefferson Davis. What you're doing is undermining the basic relationship between the states and the federal government through a, not just questionable, a ridiculous constitutional argument about the 10th Amendment and the 9th Amendment. This is, you're wasting everyone's time with this bill. It doesn't do anything, and if it does do something, it would be unconstitutional.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gutwald.
Representative Winkler, you're entitled to your opinion just like everybody else under the Constitution. But I would point out that it is not specious whatsoever for us to question the constitutionality of legislation. In fact, what this is saying is Minnesota will not do certain things to violate existing amendments under the U.S. Constitution that gives states and individuals certain powers until the U.S. Supreme Court tells us otherwise. That is absolutely true.
Madam Chair, can we have a
rotation? Yeah, why don't we do that, and then we can take more questions. I know there are several members that want to talk, and we will get to those questions. I think we'll, if it would be okay, let's do them both in a row, and then we can move on. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I'm happy to be here today to talk in support of Representative Gottwald's bill. Let me begin by saying that the version of this act has been enacted in 6 states and embedded in the state constitution of 2 states. We believe that freedom of choice in medical decisions and health insurance is an especially critical right because health care and the individual's right to life are inextricably linked. The freedom to choose doctors, treatments, medication, and insurance can make a difference in the quality and length of each person's life. The right to pay for care denied by insurance or government programs is also critically important. Patients must never have their hands tied or their lives jeopardized by laws that restrict private payments and private contracts. That said, what you may not know, Congress already forbids private payment by Medicare patients for care denied by health plans. In light of the $500 billion cut to Medicare, this bill could stand as a legal source of hope for seniors who aren't allowed to pay for the care they need. I'm pleased to see that House Files 199 acknowledges the ultimate law of the land, the U.S. Constitution, and the prescribed sovereignty of individuals and states within it. While the Constitution expressly limits what federal government can do, the Federal Health Reform Bill violates those limits and expands federal control over the most private decisions of our lives. Representative Gottwald's legislation stands up against this federal encroachment protecting the constitutional rights of Minnesota families, individuals, and patients over medical and insurance decisions. House File 199 also preserves the private contract between patient and doctor and patient and hospital. Whereas the federal law unconstitutionally imposes on individuals a mandate to purchase government-approved health insurance regardless of the cost and despite any personal objections to the coverage requirements or the imposed limits on coverage, the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act promises to uphold the individual's right to say no to such coverage, including the automatic enrollment of individuals into Medicaid without their consent. House File 199 also gives individuals the freedom to stay out of the intrusive health insurance exchange and the freedom to avoid the IRS penalty for not purchasing government-approved insurance. It will allow individuals to buy health insurance that meets their personal and financial preferences. It will allow patients to pay cash for care and doctors to accept cash for care. House File 199 will allow Minnesotans to protect their personal finances from the excesses of federally mandated coverage and costly benefit requirements. It will also allow Minnesotans to keep their health care dollars out of the hands of prepaid health plans if they so choose. For those who do not know it yet, the federal health reform law outlaws traditional high-deductible major medical and health insurance for everyone over the age of 29, essentially giving the entire health insurance industry to managed care corporations. This bill gives individuals the freedom to say no to the HMO. For all these reasons, Citizens Council for Health Freedom supports House File 199, the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act. Now, as to the questions that you asked, Representative Winkler, my apologies. I forgot my notes. The questions as to the state being involved in enforcement. I just wanted to tell you that I wrote a few things here that perhaps may highlight the concerns. And that is, although the Obamacare is a 2,700-page bill, the National Governors Association believes that there will be 250,000 pages of rules likely to be implemented much at the state level because the state is the one that the federal government is going to rely on. There's also some Medicare language in there, and conditions of participation with Medicare have to do with penalties for any of those who do not comply with conditions of participation. And then lastly, the health insurance exchange is considered essentially the enforcer of the mandate and the one that collects data. And when Stephen Parente was talking in front of the health policy division, he noted that 700 pages of the bill were used to rewrite the IRS law to allow extensive data sharing and collection for the purposes of enforcement, for the purposes of knowing everybody's real-time income 24/7. So those are some additional possibilities that you might consider.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll get the next person here as well. If you could please state your name and who you're with for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Peter Nelson. I'm a policy fellow with Center of the American Experiment, and I'm very pleased to be here today to offer testimony in support of the Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act. To begin, I would like to just state that I think really it is the role and responsibility of the state governments to act as a check against the improper exercise of federal power. The framers of our Constitution were very careful to distribute power across a number of government agencies in order to guarantee that no one accumulated too much power. The framers expected the states to work to maintain their sphere of power. In Federalist 44, James Madison made an important distinction. He looked at the federal constitution, he looked at the state constitution, he said, you know, the federal constitution actually has greater protections against abuse than state constitutions, and the reason being is because there is an intermediary that acts as a check on that, on the federal constitution. That intermediary is the state lawmaker, and that state lawmaker is expected to act as an intermediary and be a check on federal power. And I believe that's what this bill does. This bill is a check on federal power as envisioned by the framers of our Constitution. Now, I recognize that many people might not really see the point in checking federal power when the federal government's power seems to be limitless. However, I think there are still a number of good reasons for state lawmakers to work to restrain the exercise of certain federal powers. First, as Judge Vinson's ruling from Florida states, there must be some limit to federal power. And I do believe it is state lawmakers' role to try to help define that limit. Second, this law and the role of state lawmakers is not just about guarding against unconstitutional breaches. I do believe it's also about guarding against statutory breaches of authority. For instance, the ACA gives broad power to give to the executive agencies. In fact, there are actually 1,968 new and expanded secretarial powers under the ACA. State lawmakers need to ensure that these new powers are being used as the ACA intends them to be used. The ACA actually gives the Secretary of Human Services broad authority to issue regulations to meet the requirements set forth for exchanges and for health insurance markets. Section 1321 of the ACA requires the Secretary to set standards related to the establishment of exchanges, the offering of qualified health plans in the exchanges, the establishment of risk adjustment programs, and this last requirement is what might be the most troubling for a lot of us at the state level. It also allows the Secretary to issue requirements as the Secretary determines appropriate. So there are a lot of issues that remain that we've talked about this a little bit before. There's a lot of issues that remain to be worked out. There's a lot of rules and regulations that remain to be worked out. And we need to be careful to act as a check on those rules and regulations to be sure that they're not impinging on our state right, our state's rights and our individual rights. And finally, I think beyond the constitutional issues and the statutory issues, the federal action that is authorized under the Constitution or a statute may still be unwise, even if it is constitutional, even if it is statutorily correct, it may still be unwise. And state lawmakers should also be in the business of checking the unwise use of federal power. This law makes a statement on the wisdom of guaranteeing that every person in Minnesota maintains the freedom to choose or decline any mode of securing health care services without penalty or threat of penalty. I believe that is a wise statement of policy, and I believe that is a wise thing to express to the federal government. Therefore, I encourage you to support HF 199 and play a role in helping define proper bounds of federal power.
Thank you very much. I think at this time we'll go back to questions. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of points, one legal or constitutional and the other just more conceptual. I understand that reasonable people can disagree about the health law. Representative Gottwell, you are such a reasonable person. You are a reasonable person, and you and I disagree on this. That's fine. The question here is, as Representative Winkler pointed out, a constitutional one. Under what circumstances, if any, can a state opt out of laws that it doesn't like from the federal government? Now, we have a supremacy clause in the Constitution. We all agree about that. Federal law, in most cases, with some exceptions, trumps state law. There are a lot of laws on the books that were enacted under many presidents that I might not like, and I might want us to magically opt out of, but we cannot do that. There is a state prerogative, of course, to challenge the constitutionality of a state law, of course, but the way to do that is through litigation, not through enactment of state statutes, simply declaring that they don't apply. You have a provision in this bill that says, as is your right to do, that orders the Attorney General to file a lawsuit. That's a legitimate debate that we can all have. That is the proper way to challenge the federal constitutionality of a law that you may disagree with. But to simply declare by statute that we aren't doing it, not only was that settled during the Civil War, but 100 years later it was settled during the Civil Rights Struggle, where many southern states, as you know, said, we're not doing it. And the courts are very clear that you can't do that. I know that you hate the federal health care law, or aspect of it, I should say, and that you're frustrated with it. I know that it makes a lot of people mad and upset, and reasonable people, like you are, can disagree on the merits. But to simply say that by legislation, not by a lawsuit, which entitles the federal courts to decide what the federal constitution say, but in a statute to declare ourselves not bound by a law passed by the Congress and signed by the president, that's scary. I don't think it's what you intend. I hope it's not what you intend. But we had that battle during the Civil Rights era. I'm not comparing you to segregationists. I want to make that very clear. You're not. But some of these same arguments are the arguments, exactly the same arguments, that were made by people who were also confounded by a big brother federal government doing things to their culture that they didn't like and imposing their will on people throughout the Civil Rights struggle. So I want to make very clear, I'm not comparing you to the people who made those arguments, but the arguments are almost exactly the same. So the way to do this, the way to make your voice heard about what you believe, and you're entitled to that belief as an unconstitutional law, is to duke that out in the courts and not write a statute declaring that a federal law does not apply to us. I just want everyone to understand the import of what this bill is trying to do. It is saying that we can pick and choose what federal laws we want to opt in and what we want to opt out of. And that, I have to tell you, is just a breathtaking possibility here. I mean, I really ask members, even those of you who don't like this health care law and think that the federal government did overreach or believe that it's unconstitutional, that verdict has not been reached yet. And the Supreme Court will have something to say about that, but I really want everyone here to understand what they're doing and the precedent we're setting by saying that a federal law, whether you agree or disagree, it could be No Child Left Behind, it could be if you disagreed with, you know, President Bush's decision to go to war in Iraq, anything that you deem the federal government to have done that you believe, you just subjectively believe is unconstitutional, that we can say we're not doing it. We've had that fight. That's been litigated before, a century apart, in the 1860s and in the 1960s. So that's all I have to say about that. But you do have a legitimate part of the bill when you say you're directing the Attorney General to file a lawsuit. That is, I may disagree with it, I'm going to vote against it, but that's legitimate. That's legitimate to say, hey, let's have that battle about constitutionality, but let's have it where it belongs in the court. And finally, since we have devolved here a little bit into the policy, let me just say something about the rhetoric on the healthcare debate in general. I just can't resist the opportunity. Reasonable people like you, Representative Gottwald, and anyone in this room can disagree with healthcare. You can think it's a really dangerous to the republic and bad policy. But I really have to say, though I've never served on any of the Health and Human Services Committee, and you are by far more expert than I am, Representative Gottwald, in this area, this whole idea that this is a government takeover is something that has made us kind of the laughingstock of the rest of the world. There are areas in the rest of the world where all medical personnel are employees of the government. They work for the government. That's not what this bill does. There are vast parts of the developed world where there is national health insurance in Britain, in Australia, in France, in Germany, with some different flavor and variation. That is far more of a government control. That's not what the national federal health care does. You may disagree with the mandate, but the idea is laughable that somehow the federal government is going to march in with jackboots. And it's such overheated rhetoric as to be just really laughable and ridiculous. And I think the people engaging in that kind of rhetoric are going to look back 10 and 20 years ago from now and be, frankly, a little bit embarrassed by that. You may disagree. I'm not saying there are things not to be passionately opposed to in this health care bill. But to argue that this is a government takeover of healthcare, seriously. I mean, as Twyla Brace just said, if anything, there's been an argument on the other side, which is that this devolves too much power into private hands. She just said that this is basically a mandate that says we all have to purchase private health insurance from HMOs and managed care. If anything, that ought to be the criticism. This is a boon to the private sector, a huge cash windfall to health insurance companies. So I just hope we all take the tone down a little bit. People can be vigorously in disagreement with this and think it's just awful policy, but this idea that somehow, you know, our lives and our liberties are in jeopardy, it's just, it's silly. It is just so silly. And I hope we can all just take it down a notch. Just as those on the left during the Bush era said things that I bet they will all feel silly about in the next 10 years, if they don't already, about how President Bush has taken away our freedoms and the Patriot Act was an assault on every American and all the rest, I just think the partisan rhetoric about the government stomping out our rights at every turn on the left or the right, and I will call it out when I see it on the left, we just got to get away from that. We are the freest country in the world. We still are, and we will be when this is all enacted.
Not sure that there was a question there, but Representative Gottwald.
I didn't hear a question, and I'll respond briefly. Representative Simon, you're very eloquent, although I have heard the word ridiculous and some others used with regard to this. Understand very clearly, the reason this bill is here before us is about the Constitution that we are sworn to uphold. We are sworn to uphold the states' rights portions of the Constitution as well as the rest of it. We have federal judges who've already ruled that all and portions of this bill are unconstitutional. There's already some legal standing. The U.S. Supreme Court will be taking into consideration what states do around this when it makes its decision at some point in the near future. All of this plays into how we protect Minnesota's rights. We aren't talking about seceding from the Union, but these are extremely important things. And to suggest that bringing this sort of thing forward is ridiculous, that this isn't short of a government takeover, Representative Simon, I would challenge you to read and study the ACA, as some of us have done. And it is very clear that there is more than just the opportunity or suggestion of a dramatic takeover of an entire 20% of the nation's economy, which starts out with private insurance but ends up with government control. And not just employing people under the government, but government actually controlling the market and dictating what people will and won't buy. And Representative Simon and members, that is extraordinary. We have never seen that in this nation's history. So if it seems like overblown or craziness to bring this kind of thing forward, I would respectfully disagree. This is exactly the sort of thing where we have to put our flag down occasionally and say, no. Under states' rights, under the U.S. Constitution, we recognize that this is not the direction to go, that it, in fact, robs our residents, our citizens in Minnesota, of their constitutional rights, and that we are going to stand up for. So I think this is very appropriate. And as I've mentioned before, other states have already weighed in on this in a very similar manner. I might point out that lots of states said no to Real ID when that happened. That was a federal law that states refused to implement. A federal law which states refused to implement. When our own Governor Pawlenty used unallotment a couple of years ago, we heard members on your side of the aisle passionately declare on the House floor and elsewhere that it was illegal, that we were not to follow it. It was illegal. We held hearings in hearing rooms in front of cameras to declare it illegal before the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled at all. I did not at that time say that anybody didn't have the right to declare that or challenge it. In fact, I'm sure that's the right of a legislator to question those things. But understand, please, members and Madam Chair, this bill is appropriate. It's appropriate. And it states our rights as a state of Minnesota. We have declared under our oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution, which speaks directly to our rights under the Constitution. And that's exactly what this speaks to.
Ms. Bays, do you have a brief comment? I still have several member questions and have another bill on the agenda that we'd like to get to. But
thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I just wanted to address Representative Simon's comments. Representative Simon, I said what I said because it's absolutely true that the market is being given over to the HMOs. But it is in a sort of collusive agreement with the government, essentially almost like a government contractor's, where I think the HMOs are maneuvering for the system. And I would contend with you that that there are going to be lots and lots of medical decisions that will be made outside the exam room, and that even though the doctors are not the employees of the state, because of the patient-centered outcomes research institute, PCORI, and because of IPAB, which is the Independent Payment Advisory Board, that these bureaucracies are going to be able to make decisions and tell the Secretary of Health and Human Services what she should and should not say are essential benefits and what the parameters are for when care can be given. So in addition to that, the bill talks about fraud, waste, and abuse, but doesn't define them. And so it is somewhat discretionary as to how that will be defined. And for some older person, giving them care could be considered waste. So I look at some of those things and say, with that kind of federal power, even though the doctors are not going to be, quote, in the payroll of the government, their hands will be tied in ways through the bill or through the law.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm glad the level of discussion has come down a little bit here. At the beginning of this, the testimony, there was a lot of hyperbole about this, and I guess I was taking a little bit of offense to calling the America or Affordable Care Act Obamacare. I think that's offensive. It's going back to when I worked with a good friend that happened to be African American, and when blonde jokes were the rage and everyone was going around, he took offense at them as an African American, saying that calling it a blonde just changed the name and it's just another derogatory term. And I think that's what Obamacare is being used as a term. Instead of calling it what it is, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, I find offensive. And as we go forward, I mean, just to stir up people's hatred for the bill and stir up people that don't like the current president, using calling it that as a way to stir up hatred against this, against the Health Care Act. But be that as it may, I guess the question I have here has to do with, I keep hearing about rules and if the bill get passed and there's going to be this rulemaking process, which we're in this committee quite aware of and familiar with, that we pass bills in the legislature, the federal government passes bills, and it doesn't spell out exactly how things are going to get done. So how is this bill any different from any other legislation that has been passed in the past about the rulemaking? I mean, because the bill gets passed, and then you've got to have the rulemaking process to define exactly what the bill does, and then there's also legislation, not legislation, but litigation that happens afterwards, and that basically defines how the bill is enforced. So how is this bill different than any other bill that has been passed by the federal government, the rulemaking process? There have been a lot of people denigrating that, or bills that we've passed here in Minnesota State Legislature.
Representative Gowald.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, first your initial comments. I am frankly tired of hearing the argument about Obamacare. It is standard usage. Associated Press, all the major news networks, all the major newspapers in the country use the term Obamacare to describe this. Much like they used Romney Care, Bush tax cuts, Reaganomics, it's not offensive. It is a description of the bill that is used colloquially. I'm a journalist by training. This is common usage. And we hear this over and over again in committees. I'm not using it derogatorily, Representative Nelson. So we talked about bringing the hyperbole down. Let's not do that, because that's not what it's intended to do. Everybody in this room, and I dare say almost anybody in Minnesota, if you said Obamacare, would know exactly what you're talking about. Exactly what you're talking about. Now, if you said ACA, Affordable Care Act, frankly, Affordable Care Act is offensive to me, Representative Nelson, because the Congressional Budget Office has indicated this is not affordable. This is going to add hundreds of billions of dollars to the cost of health care in the nation and billions to the cost of health care in Minnesota. So, I mean, we can play games about semantics all we want, but Obamacare is common usage. Go ahead and look it up online. Take a look at all the articles. Journalists, objective people, editorials have all referred to it by both terms. And in my testimony, I referred to it as both things. So, let's try to set that point aside. To the bill, you're right, rulemaking is going on, but I think as we testified, there are aspects of this bill and what it demands of Minnesotans and individuals and the private marketplace that are unprecedented, that have never been done before. And as much as there is still rulemaking to be done, there is enough information about what this is requiring individuals and states to do to cause serious concern about how it impacts our legitimate constitutional rights as individuals and as a state. And so that's the reason this bill is before you today.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to PPACA and the constitutionality and this discussion. I'd like to understand, and an analogy I'm seeing is I went to an event that caused me to walk through a casino in the state, and I understand that was on sovereign territory or ground, and the reason why there was smoke everywhere is because certain regulations and laws and etc. don't extend into that sovereign area. And so I think we don't have to travel far to understand the idea of sovereign rights. And I understand, by reading the Constitution, of which I did in my high school and personally, that states, unless it's enumerated to the federal government, rights reserved to states and individuals. And just as any soldier takes a pledge to abide by the Constitution, public officials take a pledge to abide by the Constitution, and if a soldier gets an order that isn't constitutional, feels is incorrect, then you get a choice. You either follow that order or you suffer the consequences. And I have no problem with abiding by the Constitution and understanding that my personal interpretation thereof and state sovereignty rights could have some consequences. But I have no problem standing up and with this bill and other activities to stand on constitutional grounds and the sovereignty rights of Minnesota and its citizens. So I support this, and I do think we ought to have a roll call so we can understand the specific positions of everyone on the committee. Thank you.
The roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. Representative Winkler, did you have more questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did. Representative Gottwald, you brought up unallotment and the fact that many of us believe that it was illegal. And I wonder if you remember how that was ultimately determined and whether, in fact, those unallotments were in full force and effect until the final determination. Do you remember how that happened?
Representative Gottwald.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I'm not sure what point you're trying to make. I think my point was that legislators had a right to protest that and to do it in any means they felt appropriate. Yes, they were still in force, obviously, but that was only because you weren't able to undo them. And in fact, you ended up as a majority coming back and affirming them. But before you did that, you wanted to call it illegal, you wanted to call it unconstitutional, you did so, you held hearings, you took a lot of actions to try to prove that, and ultimately the Minnesota Supreme Court said, yeah, we consider it illegal.
But Madam Chair, the point is that we didn't pass a bill telling all of our state employees and all local employees that they should ignore them, which is what your bill does. Part of what your bill does is a protest. Your statement of findings, your purpose section, that's a protest. And I don't agree with it. I think really the legal and constitutional points you're making are quite silly. But be that as it may, you have a perfect legal right to do it. You also have a perfectly sound right to obligate the Attorney General of Minnesota to bring forward a lawsuit to challenge the federal law. Again, I think it's silly, it's a waste of resources, but you can do it, and you have a perfectly valid legal basis for doing so. But the section of the bill that is really, really, really dangerous is the one that says that the state of Minnesota won't enforce the federal law. And under your own testimony, until the Supreme Court tells us we have to. That is interposition and nullification. Those words have been through tried and true phrases that used throughout U.S. history. They are fundamentally at odds with our system of government. And Representative Gutwald, you know, I wouldn't vote for your bill if you took that section out, but we wouldn't be having this extended discussion, and I wouldn't be comparing your bill to something that would have been at home in South Carolina in the 1860s or in Mississippi in the 1960s. But that's where that section of your bill really belongs.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the record, I'm not really sure it's going to, you know, change anybody's mind here, but I did want to address a common misconception that came up in response to something that Representative Nelson had asked. The CBO report about federal health care reform, and some of us might say reform, as described in federal health care reform, I'm sorry, will ultimately reduce spending on health care. And that's why certain legislators at the federal level who are concerned, who want to introduce bills that will, if you introduce a bill that you also want to introduce a kind of companion bill that will help pay for that original bill, the federal health care reform is excluded from that requirement. And the reason is that this pay-as-you-go legislation, nobody will be able, if they repeal federal health care reform, to then pay, then recoup the consequent savings that will that you'll need to find. Sorry, it's just backwards. Thank you.
Thank you. I see one more member question right now, and then I'm also wondering if did you want to respond to that, Representative Gutwald?
Just real quickly, Madam okay. Chair. I think there's a great deal of analysis already that suggests that the CBO's findings, as well as the findings of numerous organizations across the country, is that this is going to cost more in the long run. It is not only going to cost the federal government more in terms of billions. One of the ways that it tries to show savings is by taking $500 billion from hospital payments, which eventually clicks back on. We haven't determined how we're going to pay for that yet. But because it puts more people on Medicaid, which is a state and federally funded program, this is a direct cost increase to the state of Minnesota. And we haven't even begun to rack up the total cost of that yet. But the estimate is billions. And so I would respectfully disagree with Representative Green's point of fact. And I would mention again, Representative Winkler, you're entitled to your opinion. I think the terms ridiculous and silly are offensive. This is not offered ridiculously. Again, we are standing up for legitimate Minnesota state rights and individual rights that exist under the Constitution. The section of law we're talking about and debating here between you and I is no public official, employer, agent of the state of Minnesota or any of its political subdivision shall act to impose, collect, enforce, or effectuate any penalty in the state of Minnesota that violates the public policy set forth in this section. The policy set forth in this section invokes states' rights under the U.S. Constitution. Okay, that's legitimate. And as I mentioned, many other states are already doing this. So we can argue about whether this is old South Carolina type politics or a perfectly legitimate defense of Minnesota state rights under the current U.S. Constitution.
Okay, if you could just make it very brief, because we have 12 minutes left, another bill, and I need to find out if there's anybody else that needs to testify.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Green. The CBO says that individual policies will increase by 10 to 13%, that family policies will increase about $2,100 a year, and the Medicare actuary says that he really doesn't believe the savings are going to happen because he doesn't believe that Congress is going to be willing to cut the $500 billion out and to deprive seniors of that much care as a result. So even the Medicare actuary himself is saying he really thinks that those savings aren't going to happen.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that needs to testify to this bill, wants to testify? Are there any other questions for members? Okay. I see no other additional questions. Do you have a question, Representative Quam?
I had a clarification. The statement was made that
PPACA would be savings. And, you know, we're all busy doing the people's work, and you might not have noticed that Secretary Sebelius testified, televised testimony in Congress,
and confirmed that the $500 billion in savings was being double-booked to extend the life of a federal medical program and to show that PPACA was revenue positive, of which we all know that you can't spend the money twice. And therefore, I think the basis on saying that PPACA saves and would have adequate funding is somewhat to question, but I apologize for digressing from what we are supposed to be talking about, and it's the government issue of sovereignty.
Okay, is there any other discussion? Hearing no further discussion, a roll call has been requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pepin?
Aye.
Representative Murray?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Beard?
Aye.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Hancock?
Aye.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative McFarland?
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Aye.
Representative Quam?
Affirmative.
Representative Sanders?
Aye.
Representative Scalzi?
No.
Representative Simon? Representative Erdahl?
Yes.
Representative Winkler?
No.
There being nine ayes and five nays, the motion does prevail and does pass, and House File 199 will be re-referred to State Government Finance. This time we'll take up Representative Champion's bill. I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Nelson.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File 786 to be passed and moved to Judiciary. 718, excuse me, I saw the wrong number. 718 to be moved to Judiciary. Representative Champion, please identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bobby Champion, and I am the author of House File 718. Mr. Chair, there is one oral amendment, and is it possible that we could move that oral amendment now so that the bill is in the shape desired?
Representative Green, I understand you have the oral amendment.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's to line 1.116. I move that we delete the words "and local."
Does everybody have that? On line 1.16, after the word "state," delete the words "and local."
May I speak to the amendment, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Representative Champion.
The reason for the requested oral amendment, I did have an opportunity to talk to the sheriffs, and they're okay with the bill, but they wanted that changed because they said that the individuals who will know more about a person's status would be state correctional facilities and not local jails, and we wanted to just make sure that we made that change so it was in line with their wishes.
Okay, all those anyone have any other questions about the amendment? Or all those in favor of the author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion of the amendment passed.
Mr. Chair, I understand the shortness of time, so I'll be as brief as possible. The bill in front of you is the same bipartisan bill passed by the House and Senate last session. House File 718 addresses voice concerns about felons voting in elections when not eligible. House File 718 also addresses a concern where individuals with a challenging past being discharged from probation and therefore eligible to vote under the law do not know that they can vote. Both concerns cause the problem that is addressed here in House File 718. Just so that we can go through it quickly, perhaps the bill should have started with Section 3, so let's go there first, which is on the second page. Section 3. Section 3 of the bill simply requires the court, prior to a person pleading guilty to a felony-level offense or at sentencing, to tell an individual before the court that they cannot vote under until they have been discharged from probation, simply being told from the very beginning. That's what Section 3 does. Then, if you would go to Section 2, Section 2 requires probation to notify a person that the person has been discharged from probation, and under the law, he or she's civil rights have been restored under Minnesota Statute 609.165. Under the law right now, once a person is discharged from, you know, after serving the sentence and probation and everything, their civil rights are automatically restored. Then if you look at, look under Section 2, Subdivision 2.1, it requires a designated person from a state facility to notify a person being released whose sentence is discharged that their civil rights are restored under the law. Just for clarification, the only civil rights that is not automatically restored under the law right now is for a felon to carry or possess a firearm. We are not doing anything with that. That is still the law. Now, Section 2 provides how language should appear as a means to provide consistency in the notification of the civil rights restoration. I really looked at this, you know, analogous to like a lien notice, you know, under the law and the statute. There's a way that a lien notice is performed and done and is articulated. This is just to add some consistency so that probation officers and those across the state all have a very consistent message. Finally, Section 1 of the bill calls for the Secretary of State to provide complete and accurate information about the voting rights of individuals who've been discharged or charged with a crime. And so I just want that's just something that the Secretary of State will provide electronically so that people could have accurate information. Now, the one thing that I did want to say is that this bill is not a gateway for those persons still on probation to vote. That is a discussion for another date and time, and it's not a part of this bill. So thanks again, and I hope to get your support for this important piece of public policy.
Thank you. And I was been pointed out to me that we need to make the same amendment or change on line 1.22 as we did on line 1.16. So, Representative Green, would you move that?
So moved. Thank you.
Does everybody understand that? All in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment carries. And Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Champion, I just want a clarification on lines 1.9, 1.10. They're talking about the Secretary of State having to file information charged or convict of a crime. Is that any crime? Just the clarification is, I know you were talking about felonies before. Does this include misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors? What is that?
Representative Mr. Chair, yeah. Representative Erdahl, is really for those who've been convicted of a felony, because that is what makes a person ineligible to vote.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then Representative Champion, I'm wondering if you want to specify that in line 1.9, 1.10, that it's a felony crime and not, otherwise it could leave it open for others.
I would accept that as a friendly amendment if you so move.
Representative Champion. Mr. Gehring, is there a way to get this done here? Or, I mean, this is going to judiciary. Would it be better if we had amendment drafted so you could present it in judiciary to deal with that, or can we do that here simply?
Mr. Chair, assuming I understand the amendment correctly, I think you could just do it by deleting the word crime on line 1.10 and replacing it with the word felony.
So, Representative Erdahl, would that be your amendment?
Yes.
So, Mr. Gehring, you want to repeat that so that we all have it?
Mr. Chair, the amendment would be page 1, line 10, delete the word crime and insert felony.
Does everybody understand the amendment? If so, is it all those in favor? One second, Mr. Winkler, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I guess Representative Erdahl It might only apply to felonies, but people who are convicted of other crimes might have questions about it. And so if you have a pamphlet that's applicable to everyone, then it might dispel some uncertainties of people who are convicted of other things, I guess. So,
Representative Erdahl.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Winkler, since he is focusing, Representative Champion, on felonies, I don't want Representative Quam's speeding ticket to go out on this.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure that this amendment won't prohibit the Secretary of State's office from providing full information to people convicted of all sorts of crimes, and we certainly wouldn't want Representative Quam voting illegally.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just noticing elsewhere it's called a felony level offense. Is that, should we imitate?
Talking on page 2.5.
Yeah, 2.5, and then farther down, I found it, sorry. 2.24. Oh, 2.2 and 2.4.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what the question is.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It was just a friendly suggestion that if we do the amendment where we change the word crime to felony, that we actually change it to felony level offense, because that's the language that's used elsewhere in the bill.
I would accept that as a friendly amendment, Your Honor. Mr. Chair, I'm so used to testifying in front of the court.
Mr. Gehring, does that make sense, or does that... can we leave just at crime or at felony?
Mr. Chair, it's up to the committee.
Representative Erdahl, you want to change your amendment then to make it felony level offenses?
Mr. Chairman, if that makes it more consistent, that would be fine.
We'll be voted on that. Okay. So, the amendment is going to be felony change on 1.10 from crime to felony level offenses. All those in favor of that change, that amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have what I hope is the possibility of a friendly amendment. Someone just advised me who has criminal law experience and who supports your bill that... on line 2.22, it probably isn't necessary to mention the arraignment, because these kinds of things are usually discussed in connection with a plea deal. So if you did insist on having time with the arraignment, you might want to make it an or. So it's at the time of arraignment or prior to the court's acceptance, because as it reads, it makes them disclose the information both at arraignment, which is unusual, because it's so preliminary, and then also do it prior to the acceptance of a plea, and that's probably not necessary. Again, this is a supporter of your bill who just advised me to. So if that's acceptable to the author, and I won't do it if it's not.
That's a friendly amendment.
Okay. I think, Mr. Gehring, the proper way to do it would be just say strike the words at the time of arraignment, comma. Mr. Gehring, does that make sense? Do you think that effectuates the...
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, yes.
Okay. So, Representative Simon, your motion is to amend the bill by taking out, on line 2.22, after the comma, at the time of arraignment, comma.
Correct.
Do we all understand the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment passes. Representative Quam, I understand you have a oral amendment?
Correct. It would be on line 119, after notice period, inserting the verbiage, the official must prevent invalid absentee ballots from entering or exiting the correctional facility, period. And the intent is, seeing the intent of this bill is to prevent someone from, breaking election laws and commingling invalid votes into the general pool. I see this as one more step in completeness to prevent someone from doing that.
Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what I would like to do is, if you don't mind, that we can talk about that so I can see exactly how that language fits in the structure of this particular bill, because if you think about this bill, they would not be retaining any voter registration cards at any facility at all. So it's not for them to, well, a completed or filled out registration form. It's just give them that, tell them that you now have been discharged and you have the right to vote. So they will not be sending anything from the facilities to the Secretary of State's office or to anyone at all. So I want to make sure that I have an opportunity to take a look at that and make sure that doesn't change the intent of this legislation.
Representative Quam, this bill has to go to many more sites. Do you want to work offline with Representative Champion, possibly draft this amendment in writing and have it presented either at Judiciary or along the line?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to take a few moments since we've had multiple oral amendments. And, in here it does say the official, also maintain a supply of voter registration applications. I want to take out the possibility that, someone can get a registration and register for absentee ballot, or has a change of address and has an absentee ballot sent to them. And I think it's as consistent with this language of the bill, and it is just a fairly simple preventing something from happening. Because I would assume it'd be easy enough to trace, and I don't want to have the situation that we had where an outside group comes in and then does a little bit of easy research and now you've got people on that. So I think it's simple and germane.
Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, I have had an opportunity to take a look at the proposed amendment, and I will accept it as a friendly amendment.
Okay.
And it's my understanding, if I might, that that after the word notice, that there would be an insert, the official must prevent invalid absentee ballots from entering or exiting the correctional facility.
Yeah. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I represent Champion, and while this might be a friendly amendment, I wonder if we have, and this is not a question you can answer, maybe Beth Frazier can answer it, Representative Quam, do we have prison officials right now who are experts in determining whether absentee ballots are valid or invalid? Because the validity of absentee ballots has been a huge issue, especially in 2008. We did a lot of work after 2008 to make sure that ballot boards were looking at these things, not just individuals in random places around the state. And I'd just be concerned that a prison official is not the right person to determine the validity of an absentee ballot.
Maybe Ms. Frazier could give some insight into this. And welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. And as I understand the proposal, it's not about whether the absentee ballot envelope is filled out correctly. It's about whether the person receiving it is eligible to vote. And I think we all agree that somebody that is incarcerated for a felony level offense is not eligible to vote. I think the question I would ask is, without the Department of Corrections here, how easily they think they can remove this mail? Because that's the part I don't know. So,
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Since in here we are having the Secretary of State supply a list. They're educating, they're generating publications, etc., on the voting rights and civil rights of a felon. I think that inherent in this is that you are generating and providing information to And you notice it's the official, and that's the official that is also, you know, may supply the voter registration and is overseeing this. So it would be the official that is defined in this piece of legislation to be the informed and the expert person to be able to appropriately handle this to avoid there being a you know, an issue. And we're here to inform, you know, so I guess I'm assuming that you're appropriately covering information and publication and notification and training of the specified official in the legislation. If you're not, then I have concerns about the validity of the, you know, bill. If you're not appropriately educating the person that's supposed to be implementing and making sure that people know, you know, when they've lost a right and when they've gained that right back.
Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe that your concerns are an important concern, but it's not one that should be rooted in this particular bill. If I might suggest that the only time the official comes into play, for lack of a better word, in this bill is upon the discharge that a person is leaving a prison. They're not staying, they're leaving. And on their way out, that's why there is language that says the official may. It is not a directive saying you shall. So if you have a supply of voter registration applications, you can say, hey, by the way, now that you're discharged, you are eligible to vote. Here's a card, you can take it with you. It is not to suggest that the person stays there and fills it out and now the facility be responsible for sending it to anyone. And so I just want to make sure that that's clear, because I think that we're now starting to go someplace else, which is not the intent of this bill at all. So even though there would be information provided by the Secretary of State's office electronically, everyone knows those things, they are not in a position, nor will they be required to accept any applications and to authorize and make sure that this person, you know, filled it out correctly or that it's a legitimate absentee ballot. That's all. So what I am interested in doing, Representative, if you have some additional questions, as the chair so eloquently articulated earlier, this bill is going to go through different committees, and if we can have an opportunity to talk to corrections or talk to anyone else, or if I'm able to talk to you more so that you have a better sense, or maybe that I'm not hearing something that you're saying, so that we can work that out. So I make that commitment to you as we go forward.
Representative Kwong. Any more questions on this amendment? If not, all in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The amendment fails. Mm-hmm. To the bill. Are there any more questions on the bill? Beth Frazier, Ms. Frazier, would you have anything to say on the bill? Or
Mr. Chair, do we have a quorum present to move forward on this piece of legislation?
Yes, we do. We have 8 members.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say briefly that our office strongly supports this legislation. We thank Representative Champion for bringing it forward again. Most of the felons who do vote did not realize that they did not have the right to do so, so this will ensure that they are informed of that. It will also ensure that people, when their rights are restored, are informed of that. And to the extent that after this bill is passed, if a felon did cast a ballot, it would allow them to be more easily prosecuted, because you could prove that they knew that they were not supposed to vote. So it would be helpful all the way around.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Is there anybody else who would like to speak for or against this bill? If not, seeing as how we're 15 minutes over, all those in favor of the bill, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Nay.
The ayes have it. Bill's been passed. With nothing else to come before us, did we pass the minute? Okay. Nothing else coming before us, meeting's adjourned.